history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. There are men and women who have extraordinary stories to tell, even if they seem like ordinary people. Once we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to their stories, we're amazed. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The gentleman you're going to meet today is 96 years old, a lifelong resident of the San Francisco Bay Area, except for his time in the U.S. Army during World War II. He's a little hard of hearing because of all the artillery he had to listen to over in Europe during World War II, so I might shout a little bit. Al Bertoli joins us now. Al, you grew up here in San Francisco.
Yes, sir.
So what was San Francisco like before the Golden Gate Bridge? You were here before that.
It was a great place to live. I remember all us kids. It's not like today. We played kick the can, one foot off the gutter, heats and hockey, all those games. We really enjoyed ourselves. We used to take and eat apricots, take the shell, rub it on the sidewalk, and make a whistle out of it. That's the entertainment we had. The PG&E used to have buckets of wax when they got finished and left. Us kids used to go and put our hands in and get a shape of a hand under the wax. It was a great life. All the doors were open. There was no gates or anything like that. Everybody knew everybody. In my neighborhood, there was about 30 of us that really run around together. And right today, myself and Nancy D'Amico are the only ones left. Great bunch of people, I'll tell you. I watched them build the Golden Gate Bridge. I was 17 years old. They had a cage on the corner of Fillmore and Chestnut. If people got in trouble down there with the cowboy hats and stuff, they put them in this cage, and it was a great celebration, it really was. To see that bridge and all those people, when it opened, it swayed so much, they thought it was going to come apart. I mean, there was too many people on it. It was full. We traveled over that bridge. It was 25 cents. Then it went to 50 cents. Now I believe it's over $6. I don't go over it no more. But anyhow, it is a great city. You got a lot of technology today that made the world change. And one day I went back. I had my grandmother, my grandfather. They taught me to talk Italian. I talked so much Italian, I didn't know much English. When they passed away, that's when I started to go to school and start to speak English. But I went back one day to Balboa Cafe, which is on Fillmore and Greenwich, and up the street is the firehouse, and then two houses from that was my grandfather's and grandmother's. They had two garages. They had a long stairway going up, a long alleyway going up to the back steps. He had a garden. He had rabbits. He had goats. And he was a produce man. He had a horse and wagon, used to sell produce. And then the fish man went out on Friday. And then the rags and bottles sack man, he was running around picking up stuff. But, you know, those were so great. And then what we loved was when the harvest come in for grapes. And all the Italians, you know, they all got maybe a ton of grapes or half a ton, whatever it was. And they would make their wine. Well, when the trucks had driven down the street, all us kids would run and holler, Fuji. So the kids would come out, we'd grab a bunch of grapes and throw them to each other, you know. It was a lot of fun. But I'll tell you what, today will never match what I had and what I have seen, believe me.
What would you say you missed the most about San Francisco of the 1930s?
I miss all my friends, miss my family. But anyhow, I went back there to see my grandfather's house. And I looked there, and it's all shingled in front and everything. I couldn't believe it. So I rang the bell. Lady answers, and I says, I'm sorry. I says, I hope I didn't bother you, you know. And I says, my grandfather and grandmother used to own this property. They said, no, there's 5 units here now. She says, I'm one of the units. See, my grandfather had 2 garages on each side, one on each side. Then he had the barn in the back. Then he had the goats in his special pen. He had the rabbits under the house, under the back stairs, rather. Then he had his garden up the backyard. And that's the way. That's the way we ate, you know. I mean, we went to the store. I went to this butcher shop, and for 25 cents, you get top round New York steak or whatever you want, you know. But today, you buy a New York steak, it's $16, $19 a pound. I can't believe it.
Well, and you would know because you spent most of your life as a butcher. But when did that start? How old were you when you first got going in that meat business?
My father and mother had separated. My father was a playboy. I'm sorry to say that, but that's what he was. I didn't have much contact with him. He had a bar, a restaurant. I used to go down there before they widened Lombard Street and do the dishes and cut the meat and make the salads. But after that, when they widened Lombard Street, I never seen him much. He went up to Reno and up to Winnemucca and I don't know where else. But anyhow, he was a bartender. And what he forgot to do is pay the IRS, the taxes for his bar. So he was out of state. When he come back with his new wife, they caught him. And then my father had received the cancer of the brain. I went down. My father had a pistol with a case. And that case was a replica of the pistol. He wore it so long. And I asked his ex-wife, or whatever she was, if I could have it. She says, it's gone. He had a beautiful diamond ring. He said he wanted to give it to me. So I asked her for it. She says, no, we had it changed. It's not yours anymore. That was the end of that story.
How old were you when you started as a butcher?
13. I was scraping blocks. And them days, we had sawdust on the floor. You're going to like this one. And if you dropped something on the floor, it would get full of sawdust. We would take a beef tongue and rub it down that piece of meat. And that beef tongue, the way the whatever it had on its tongue, would take that sawdust right off. See? And then we take and fix it up nice and put it back in the counter. But that's the way it was in those days. And then I used to scrape the blocks. I learned from a left-hand butcher, Ansonino Lynch was his name. He'd bring calves in and we'd have to skin them. So he was trying to teach me how to skin. He's left-handed, right? I'm right-handed. Boy, did we get into some arguments. He says, Alberto, you're not going to learn. You're not going to learn. Well, I skinned a lot of calves when I got older, I'll tell you. But anyhow, I scraped blocks there for him and another butcher shop on Buchanan between Filbert and Greenwich. Frank Squataguazza was his name. And I scraped his blocks, cleaned the glass, and changed the sawdust, everything else that he had to do, the bathrooms and everything. And I used to make, about 75 cents a week from him and 75 cents a week from the other. So I had $1.50. That was a lot of money. So what I did, I used to go out to the Presidio of San Francisco, and I go to where they make the bread. And we could buy bread for 1 cent. So I buy 2 or 3 loaves of bread for 3 cents. I bring them home. We'd have butter, bread, and peanut butter, or just sop bread into gravy and have it like that. We'd clean the plates, and a lot of spaghetti and macaroni. That's the way we lived. And then, you know, the old-timers, they did a lot of cooking. Today, the people can't do the cooking because they both have to work to make ends meet.
What was the best Italian specialty your mother used to make?
My mother, minestrone. Boy, I'll tell you. And, you know, I don't know if people ever heard of it. But I had an uncle, Gene Della Maggiore, and my aunt used to make minestrone for him about 3 times a week because the other 2 days or 4 days, he used to put farina in it, which is cornmeal. It thickened it, and he'd eat it that way for 2 or 3 more days. But, you know, it was easy to live then. I mean, gas was 10 cents a gallon. The Balboa Cafe, I remember on Sundays, they had family lunches. And the family lunches consist of a salad, soup with bread, and then they have all a bunch of cold cuts. They fix chicken. And I keep trying to find out how from somebody. They don't know how. But they fix it in such a way that it was so delicious. They did it in a frying pan. And you know how much that costs? 75 cents. With your dessert, too. Uh-huh. 75 cents. Yeah. My father had the restaurant. He charged 75 cents for dinners.
I'm sure you have a ton of stories from San Francisco back then, but I'm curious about what you remember about December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you heard what happened?
In Hillsborough, California, with my friend Walter Davini and his brother Ernie, and we were at his grandfather's ranch. His name was Torquio. Walter was in the house, and he heard that the United States declared war on Japan. And we all looked at each other, went down. Ernie went in the Navy, Walter went in the Army. I was supposed to go with the Coast Guard because I had a dentist out in Geary Street that knew somebody down there, but I didn't go and see him, and I went and joined the Army. But that was a hard feeling because all of us, most of the guys, they all went to the Navy, and they were in Guam or someplace in there. Some of them met each other over there, you know. But I was out in the Bulge in Germany. I had this fellow with me. His name was Geisinger. He was in the Arctic Circle for a long time. I think it was 3 years. So he come, and he was in our division, and I happened to be his partner. So we dug holes together and everything, you know. When we dug holes in that shale, you'd use gloves because the shovel, it's loosened it, but you'd have to use these, your hands to take out all the rocks, all the shale. So we built a pretty good hole, and him and I went down into town and got a door off a house. And we packed that up at this hill in the Bulge, and we had a good view of it. In fact, I was on the right flank. Tarpley was in the front. Carney and Bartosik, they were in the left flank. Geisinger and I were in the middle, and we got this hole dug, put the door over it, put all the shale back on top of it. So Geisinger had good hearing. He said, "Hey, hit it. Hit the ground." That's what for. He said, "Hit the ground." And he could hit us. The 88. And boy, when it hit, it hit it. So Topley says, "Hey, you guys come up here into this foxhole." He says, "Stuff is coming in pretty heavy." I looked at Geisinger. He looked at me. Pretty soon here comes another 88. He goes, "We both got in and hit that foxhole." We went in where we dug. Not where he wanted us to go. It was real close.
So the guy told you to jump in a hole that actually got hit. Good thing you didn't listen to him, huh?
Yep.
I want to come back to that, but I want to take you to before that. Because when you first got into the Army, you were an MP in California. People have heard a lot on this program about the Japanese internment, the Japanese Americans on the West Coast sent to the camps. You were at the Manzanar internment camp as military police, a guard. Was that strange for you? Because I'm sure you knew some Japanese people growing up, right?
Oh, I met a lot of Japanese people in San Francisco when I grew up. I had two real good friends, Buster and Frank. They come into my house all the time, sat down, had lunch or something with us and everything. I'll tell you, the Japanese people that I knew, I went to school with and everything, they were great people. I mean, there was, sure, the United States, they're not going to take any chances. So they round up all the Japs and put them into a camp, which I don't think was right myself. I mean, they could have went in and figured out who was what and what was who, but they didn't do that. And it was a shame because the way those people had to live in those camps, and then they had to go out and make gardens of vegetables and watermelons and what have you, so they'd have stuff to eat. It was a bad situation.
Well, that must have been hard for you then to be a guard there and to see them basically as prisoners, and you're one of the guys that makes sure they're not taken off somewhere or doing anything. Was that difficult for you?
You know, you're in a big tower, and you're running a searchlight. That's as far as it got with me. And then we had to dig pits so we could get into and have our machine guns there. In case something come up, we could have it all around the center, you know. Those poor people, there's little kids and everything. You know, today, there's still some of those people living. the younger generation. They're great people. I take my hat off to them for what they did and what they accomplished after they were released from these camps.
And when you say you had to dig those pits, you guys were preparing for the possibility that they would try to stage a revolt.
Yeah, we thought they were going to escape. We did. When you took them out and into the fields, you had to watch, because if they decided to run, you know, you either have to tell them to halt or shoot them, one or the other. And once they get loose, they're not going to stop. I wouldn't stop. I'd keep going if it was me.
I bet you're glad you never had to do anything like that, huh?
No, never. Thank God.
But you did get yourself into some trouble there. They said you stole some watermelons?
Well, they grew a lot of watermelons. One machine gun pit was all full of watermelon husks. And I got blamed for it, okay? Because I was out there stealing one watermelon, and they declared that I did them all. So that's when I went on duty.
And what was that duty?
That duty was to take and dig holes for gas tanks to take out of the ground, a grease pit. Go in the morning, they get a truck, load it up with rocks, put it all around this perimeter. Then I painted it white, and I printed on the highway, I printed chicken. Anyhow, the rest of it you could hear.
So you're supposed to paint the rocks, but you paint this message to your superiors on Highway 395. How did they react to that? Did they think it was a big joke and laugh it off?
How'd they react to that? They didn't like it, man. They decided what they were going to do with me, especially Captain Nails, because Lieutenant Hass and Lieutenant Singer, they liked me, and they were ready to give me promotion and everything. They told me, Al, this is what you got to do, you know. So after I did that job, they told me to fill all the stoves in the barracks with oil. So I did a wonderful job there till I got to the CP. When I got to the CP, I was pouring oil in the stove, and Lieutenant Hass was talking to Captain Nails, telling him that he would like to give me a promotion. And when Captain Nails said that, I thought the whole camp outside heard it. He said, no way, no way, that man is going to get a promotion. Then that's when I told him I wanted to go, wanted to transfer. I was reading the Times, and they said they needed people in the front line. Well, the people in the back line were doing a good job, too, believe me. And that's what edged me to go.
So because you knew you weren't going to get a promotion there, you just said, even though this is going to put my life in jeopardy, I want to go overseas. Were you nuts or what?
I didn't think so at first. But when I got in the front line, I told myself, what an idiot you are.
Well, and we're going to find out what exactly made him feel that way when we come back. 96-year-old Alberto Bertolli of Belmont, California is our guest today. If you want to see what he looks like, pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 96-year-old Alberto Bertoli of Belmont, California, a lifelong resident of the San Francisco Bay Area. In fact, you'll still find him playing bocce ball in downtown San Francisco every Tuesday. In late 1944, he found himself on the freezing front lines of Europe with the rail splitters of the 84th Infantry Division, from France to the Netherlands to Germany. What were you doing over there, Al?
Well, we were up in the front line. And all we had to do was make sure the enemy didn't come in. I remember one time we had so much fire trying to get to the bulge that we had to jump off a railroad bridge to get to where we wanted to go. There was a lot of mortar fire behind us, and we had to keep moving because they really had us zeroed in. So that's when we finally got into where I told you, that railroad station where that 88 come in.
Well, when you say jump off a railroad bridge, what was below you? What did you jump off onto?
I landed on a kind of an island on the side of it. I didn't jump straight down. Oh, I'd say it was about 10 feet. I had a BAR and an automatic.
Browning automatic rifle, yeah?
I had that thing and I hit it across my knees when I landed. Boy, I thought that was the end, you know. But I made it. I made it to where I was supposed to go. And then, like I say, I went into that railroad station and 88 hit.
Yeah, tell us that story. You're in the railroad station with a friend of yours, right?
Yeah.
And what happened? You guys were trying to figure out where to go?
No, we were pulling guard duty because everybody was down below in the center. We pulled guard duty. I think it was 10 minutes at a time, or 15, I forget now. But anyhow, in this railroad station, there were doors at both ends. And this one fella that I, Sergeant, he told me to get away from the door where I was standing, close to this little room. And then there was another door that went to the cellar where all the rest of the GIs were. So when he said this stuff is coming in, and I moved to the door and went to the cellar, he moved in my place, and 88 hit where he was standing, and he died. So I took him, carried him downstairs, called the medics. He was gone. He was gone. That shrapnel went right through him. It was a sad day, boy. I couldn't get over that for about a week and a half, before I could really know what I'm doing and what I'm here for, you know?
You were just in kind of a daze from that?
Yeah. And that's how I lost a lot of my hearing. There's the 155s, the 88s, and all the shells coming in. You know, when they bounce you off the ground and hit close by and everything starts to fall apart, you start to think then, how long is this going to last? You know, you want to get out and get home. I was stupid when I volunteered for the infantry. I should have stayed where I was.
You described that, you know, when a shell hits and bounces you off the ground, when it hits that close by. Is that something that was frequent?
Oh, yeah. You know, I remember one time there was a place that was snow. We were trying to get this town. We were crawling along this place, but there was a drop down there, and you could stay there, and the Germans would fire on us, you know. But I got halfway up, and my buddies Connie and Bartosik says, "Al, come back, come back." And I tried to get up, and they stopped firing at me. So I laid down, and I could see the bullet holes coming through the snow. I tried to back up, but with those overcoats they give us, if you back up, you're going to get a ton of snow in them. So Connie and Bartosik told me, says, "Al, you better get up. Hell of high water, get up." So I got up a little bit, went down, and they fired on me. I got up and run like the Dickens and get into this cave-like. And then I was all right. But I had snow packed up inside of me, you can't believe.
Well, of course, that's what the Battle of the Bulge is so legendary for, is the weather and how cold it was and how much snow. And you guys got in pretty early, just a couple days into the Battle of the Bulge. The 84th got there. So how bad were those weather conditions? What was the hardest part for you with the weather?
They were cold. They were cold. I'll tell you what, I change my socks every day. Dirty or not, I change them because you get frostbite. We took care of ourselves pretty well. But, you know, you're there trying to save your country. In the meantime, you're trying to save yourself. And so are they. I mean, Some of those people are told to do the same thing we're told to do. They probably have families and kids. I'll tell you an incident. One time, I was on top of this place, like I told you, where we packed the door from town, put it over that hole. I was on the right flank. I walked over to the edge, and this is five Germans. I took my carbine. I fired over them, you know. I didn't shoot at them. I just fired over them. I figured, they're probably running to get home or whatever. They're not coming back. Those guys probably have a family. And I let them go. Maybe I shouldn't. They didn't have any ammunition. They didn't have any rifles. They didn't have any BARs or anything like that. It was unreal. They had a canteen in their hand. That's the only thing they had.
And you just said, maybe I shouldn't have. I'm sure that's something you've thought about a lot over the years. I wonder if there were any times where there was a German who did the same thing for you.
I don't think so. Because they were told by the greatest nut in the world what to do. And I mean a nut. I think if we went head to head, we'd have to fire it at each other. And it's a shame. It's a shame, but I was lucky to come home. All I lost was my hearing, and I had to fight the VA for years. Just recently, they acknowledged that I had lost the hearing. When they took my test and everything, they told me, Al, I don't know how you can hear at all, because there's nothing on the monitor that shows your hearing. So they're trying to get me something that's not going to be enormous. It's going to be a little better and more clarity. I still drive. I just bought a brand new car. They said to me, would you buy a brand new car for you? 96 years old. If I don't spend the money, somebody else is going to spend it. So I bought a brand new car.
Back when you were a much younger man in Europe during World War II, is there something that you would say now was the most frightening thing you had to face? The thing that got to you the most or made you wonder the most whether you were going to come home?
Yeah, when we crossed the Rhine River. Across the Rhine River, we had quite a ways to go. There was a wall we had to jump. We got out into this house, went upstairs. There was a pole right in front of that window. And the three of us were standing there. Bartoszek was the one who was in front. An 88 come in and split that pole. Something, the fragments come through that window. They hit Bartoszek. Wasn't bad, but he had to go back to the CP and then go to the hospital. And about a week later, he come back. But what I didn't like at night, we were in the building. These airplane German Luftwaffe would fly over. They would drop bombs. Boy, you don't know where they were going to hit. That was frightening, very frightening, because you're trying to cross a river and paddle to get to the other side, you don't know if you're ever going to make it. I mean, when they dropped those bombs out of their planes, I mean, they're running that river. Not one plane, they're coming two or three. And I mean, they were close, real close, too close for comfort.
Well, and on that thing with the window, it sounds like you're saying if that pole wasn't there, you wouldn't be here.
No, because that 88 hit that pole. And it's all the splinters and everything hit that window. Broke the glass. I guess part of the glass hit Bartoszek. The medics took him away, and then we left there, went on to the Elbe River. That's when the Germans started coming over the river. They didn't want to surrender to the Russians, so they wanted to surrender to us. Well, I didn't have any rest for about 3 days. Not only me, the rest of us. I was pulling guard duty. I started to doze off, and the German officer come and tap me on the shoulder. He says, surrender, surrender. I put my pistol out. He says, okay. So I took him down to CP. CP, where'd you get him? I said, I got him crossing the river. I didn't tell him I was half asleep.
You know, Al, that's the first time anyone's ever told me that. I didn't know you could capture someone while you were asleep. That's pretty impressive.
Asleep. I was just dozing off. And when somebody touched me on the shoulder, first thing I did was went for my pistol. And boy, I mean, they were coming on the Elbe River. All they wanted to do was surrender to them. We got a bunch of them. You know, that was the best place it ever was while we were in the service. There was a warehouse or a storage for lockers, frozen food stuff. One day, one of the guys said to me, hey, Al, you was a butcher, wasn't you? I said, yeah. He said, you know, I was stationed on duty in this storage place. And you ought to see the meat they got stacked to the ceiling. I said, oh, yeah? He said, why don't you come the first chance you get, come and see what we can do. You know, I said, okay. So it was about 5-6 miles away, I guess. We get there, man alive. These rooms just stacked to the ceiling with beef. Couldn't believe it. Butter in barrels. I was on the second floor. I took this one barrel, I threw it out, let it fall on the ground. From the second floor, you know what was in it? Strawberries. It was full of strawberries. So we got one hindquarter down. We set it out to thaw. I said to the guy, I says, you know, there's a car out there, but you got to fire it with wood. So if you guys can get the wood, we'll fire it and get this hindquarter in there, get it back to where I'm at. When it thaws out, I'll cut it up. We share the meat. So we did. And we cut that hindquarter up. Shared meat and everything. Oh, there was vegetables. There was bread. But this stuff is all frozen. They're prepared to live forever. I could not believe it. But I'll tell you, they sure had this warehouse full. They really did. They were thinking for 100 years, believe me. Because the meat that they had in there, you know what a hindquarter weighs? About 180 pounds. And you stack that thing one on top of the other, and they're probably about 8 inches thick. They go in the storage from the floor to the ceiling. It's a long way. And we got 8-foot ceilings. They don't have 8-foot ceilings.
Well, yeah, so they were gearing up for an exhaustive supply. But the reason it was such a big deal to you and your friends is I bet you hadn't eaten food like that in a long time.
No, in a long time. All it was K-rations.
While you were over there, did you ever hear anything about the concentration camps? About what the Nazis were doing?
Yeah, I heard about them. Yeah. The way they burned people and stuff like that. The Germans?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You ought to see the holes they dug. They just piled bodies. And they one on top of the other. There was something else, man. I seen the after part when we come back. But, see, I was with the F Company, 335th Infantry, and 333rd C Company, I think, had the worst part of the fighting than we did. We didn't have the worst part, but we had a good deal of it, you know. You know, they were taught. You know, the kids, we were going up a road into this town, and we got fire, and it come from a steeple in a church, Hodges. He was walking up the middle of the road, and all he carried was grenades in his pocket and a pistol. He lives in Eureka, California. I went to see him. He went up and says, keep going, keep going. And we kept going, figured, hey, this guy's going to hit us. Finally got up there and the guys got into church. Was a kid. They were holding us back so the other ones could back off. Another time, I was on the line. I don't think it was more than 50 yards away. Sergeant Zales, he was with me. We're in this hole. And the Germans were about 50 yards away. There was a truck between us, loaded with ammunition. They hit that truck. You can't believe the flight that we had. They had hit this box of ammunition that we had. So Zales says to me, Al, you've got to go get some ammunition. I said, you know what, Zales? Screw it. If you want the ammunition, you go get it. I'm going to fix the bayonet. Stay in this hole. If they come, I'm going to die fighting them. But I said, I'm not getting out of this hole. He got out and went and got the ammunition. That's the worst thing I ever seen. That truck just lit up like a stove, wooden stove. It was unreal. I'll never forget that.
I bet you felt the heat of that.
Oh, I know. You felt the heat. It felt good.
Melted some snow around your feet?
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's a funny thing. I always wore extra stuff on my feet because I didn't want to get frostbite. Guys used to tell me, hey, you're crazy. I said, I might be crazy. And another thing I did, they had mines. I always walked in the footsteps of the guy that was 3 feet in front of me. Never made another. One time, he was about 10 feet away from me. Stepped on the mine, lost his legs. The medics come up. They took care of him, took him away. But the steps after that, I put my foot on. Never made a new one. Precaution.
Well, and clearly that paid off because he made it home, and he's still driving at age 96. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Al then and now, including some from his experience last year with Honor Flight Bay Area. We'll discuss that trip of a lifetime when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to get to know a lively 96-year-old, Alberto Bertoli of Belmont, California. Perhaps he prepared a cut of meat or two for you over the years. He started in the butcher business at age 13 and kept it up for most of his life, with a little interruption during World War II. We heard about how he gave up his duty as an MP at the Manzanar internment camp to volunteer for overseas service, and we heard about all his close calls with the 84th Infantry Division in Europe, including the infamous Battle of the Bulge. But what about coming back home from the war, Al? What was that like?
That was really ticklish. I had all this money that I had spread around on board the ship, the different people that I could take, exchange it in the United States. Well, forget it. All that money that I sent out was gone. I couldn't pick those guys out anymore, okay? Only money I could exchange is what I had. Then I had to take Connie and I had to fly home, and he lived in Los Angeles. The plane we had, shake, rattle, and roll, believe me. I didn't think it was going to make it. But anyhow, Connie says, hey, why don't you come down and stay with me? I says, you know, Connie, right now I can't. I says, the family's waiting for me. They're going to meet me at Sacramento. Campia. My sister, my brother-in-law, and my mother were there. And it was January the 6th, because my mother let this Christmas tree stay up so I could see it. It was a great, great day. I'll tell you, to set my foot on the ground of the United States of America, this wonderful, beautiful country, that people worked hard to make it what it is today. Not only the soldiers, the people that worked building ships and all airplanes, tanks and whatever. And you know, it's a great country to know that you have people like that. It really is.
Did your mom make you some minestrone when you came home?
No, first thing I told her, we're going down to Balboa Cafe. She says, what for? I said, I want to get a pecan punch. I'd love to drink. I don't know if you know what they are. Pecan punch comes in the stem glass. What you do is you put a little grenadine in it, and then you put a little bitters in it. You put the ice. Then you put pecan, amber pecan, which comes from France. Well, they stopped sending it. I don't know why. And then you float it with brandy and a lemon peel. Man, is that good. The only place I could find it now is Nick's in Half Moon Bay.
You mentioned your mother leaving the Christmas tree up for you.
Yeah.
It strikes me that the Christmas before was a lot different.
I was in a hole, freezing my butt off.
The Battle of the Bulge, that was your Christmas in 44. Was there anything to distinguish that day as Christmas?
Well, you know, all of us thought about it. You know, when you're in battle like that, that's the only thing you think about is saving your life and getting back to your family, especially people that had kids and stuff like that. It was a shame that they had to be in the front line with the kids at home. But anyhow, you know, it come to my mind, Christmas, and that was it. Just come to my mind. I could see the Christmas tree. I'm a good visualizer. I can visualize everything. I could visualize this tree where we used to have it all the time, the presents and everything, what we had Christmas Eve, what we had Christmas Day, all the family. I mean, today you don't have that. The kids are doing one thing, boom, 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 with their little thing. They don't know anything else. It's a shame. Technology.
Yeah. But so you're there, you're freezing in a foxhole in the Battle of the Bulge, and you're imagining your childhood and all the Christmases you had and who would be there and what you're doing and what you're eating and all of that.
That's right. When we had a holiday, it wasn't one item. In them days, like Easter, you know what a capretto is? A capretto is a small goat. I say the whole thing probably weighs 10 pounds. I work for Giorgio Jacopi on Union and Grand Avenue. He used to get 500 capretti every year for Easter. That was a big thing for the Italians. We used to get a half of one for just one family, a whole one for maybe two or more. But that was the main dish, that and rabbits. Rabbits years ago, everybody had them. But Easter was a great day. And then we went to North Beach. We get St. Arnold rain cakes. DeAndre's Bakery makes now, on 24th and Mission. But it was a great day. I mean, it was just eat, eat, eat.
You described those holidays with your big Italian family, Christmas and Easter, and the inspiration for those holidays. I wonder when you look back at an 88 shell that kills the guy next to you, an 88 shell that lands in the hole next to you, an 88 shell that hits that pole, and how many windows have a pole in front of them to save your life. All the close calls. How do you explain it? Was someone looking out for you? Was it just pure luck? What's your explanation?
I don't know. I really don't know. I was lucky. That's all I can say. I was scared to death. I can't say I'm a hero, but none of us are heroes. We're all scared to death, but we do what we have to do. And these people, like some of us that get out there and do this thing, they end up with a bunch of purple hearts. I don't believe in that. You know, you lose a leg or two, and it's hard to get back to doing what you want to do. I was just lucky.
Well, and you're not looking for sympathy or asking for anyone to feel sorry for you.
No way.
But you've had to deal with a loss of hearing for most of your life. How has that affected you?
I can't lift my arms any higher than this. And I got this tremor. And then I got two bad knees, I got two bad hips. In fact, I'm going in for a shot next week for my hip. My legs, I got one foot that has the gout, and the other foot has hematomas. So I just go along with it. I live a good life.
Well, and I want to ask you about a big adventure you had about a year ago with Honor Flight Bay Area.
Oh.
What was that like for you to go back to Washington, D.C.?
Hey, that was the greatest day I ever had. Joe was my guardian, and Joe Fry is one of the greatest people I ever met. I feel like he's my son. And you know what? When we took off from here, we were down the airport, and all those people down there waving us off and everything, it was great. And the people that I met, all of us, had wheelchairs. There's 26 of us on the bus. There was 26 wheelchairs. Every place we stopped, they took out 26 wheelchairs and 26 GIs sat in them. And the guardians wheeled us all over. And there was many, many things to see. The GIs that had died is unreal. Arlington Cemetery has 58,400 GIs just in one place. And then you have the Korean War. My God, you can't believe how many people that are on that wall. It's sad to see. But you go there and you have these memories and never forget them. And I'll tell you what, I had a real good time. Joe wheeled me around. And then it started raining, so he had ponchos. He put a poncho on me, put one on himself. He said, "What, do you want to go back?" I said, "You kidding?" I said, "Let's keep going." So we kept going. And the best thing I ended up seeing, they had a fountain. I was looking at all these things that there were, you know, all these memories and things that they had. And I see this fountain. I go over and I look at it, and it had the Bulge written on it. I was so happy to see that, you know. And it showed that at least they represented something, and they put us there.
You mentioned that fountain where it says the Battle of the Bulge. That's part of the World War II Memorial. And I guess if snow couldn't stop you at the Battle of the Bulge, the rain couldn't stop you from seeing that monument. But real close to that is that wall of gold stars. When you looked at that wall of gold stars, knowing that's 406,000 Americans who died in World War II, what were you thinking about there?
I thought how lucky I was. I said my prayers, made the sign of the cross for their wives. I don't know if they had families or not, but I felt sorry for everyone that passed away.
And then you came back, and I bet San Francisco was waiting for you.
I tell you, what a reception we had. People taking pictures and flags and Scotch Guard and everything. The MPs. It was unreal. The people that were waving, touching us, everything. And the people that I went with are the greatest people I ever met. All these GIs, one of them maybe in the airplane pilot, and maybe another was in the Navy. But whatever, they were great people. And they served their duties and everything. And these guys and myself all got pushed around Washington, and what a great time it was. It was beautiful, really was. I'd never seen so many people congratulating us. Thank you for, you know, what you did. I could not believe it. And then we hit San Francisco, the same thing.
How did that make you feel?
Oh, hey, your heart's going like this. I tell you, you're shaking, your eyes, there's a lot of guys got the little, you know, eyes starting to cry a little bit. It's the greatest feeling to have somebody or people like that to come out and meet you and thank you for what you did. But we got to thank them for what they did. A lot of people during the war helped make tanks, guns, the whole works. I take my hat off to them, especially these women driving these 3/4-ton trucks and everything. They did a real good job, man.
Well, not to pile on, but I'd like to say thank you also. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. How about, here's a question for you. Early on in the war, you're guarding these Japanese Americans in an internment camp. A lot of them volunteer from the camp to go serve. They go and they liberate your ancestral homeland of Italy.
That's right.
How about that? How crazy is that?
Right. I seen a picture of those, all those Japanese guys. And I don't know why they didn't speak more about them. They didn't see too much about these guys. And I give them a lot of, take my hat off to them. I give them a lot of credit for what they did. They really did. It was a wonderful thing. Inspiration.
So you're 96 now. Have you started to think about your 100th birthday yet?
I'm going to be 97 in August. I'll be there.
Is there something that you haven't done yet that you're still looking forward to, besides the Giants winning another World Series?
Oh, that I was sad. Anyhow, I would like to take a trip, see the Panama Canal, go to Europe, see the places I've been. That would be a great thing. I'm a happy-go-lucky guy. I think I can do this. I think I can do that.
Last question I have for you is, at 96, with everything you've experienced, what would you say you're most proud of?
The most proud of is getting through all the things that tried to resist me. Fought and worked hard from the time I was 13 years old. Never lost a day of work. I'm proud of what I've accomplished. And I still drive. You know, I told them my license doesn't expire until 99. So I told them, I said, when I'm 99 years old, I'll go back and renew my license. They looked at me, are you still driving? I said, yeah, I'm still driving. You're 96 years old and you're still driving? I said, I love the drive. And I said, I don't pick along like an old man.
Move over, Mario Andretti. 96-year-old Alberto Bertolli coming through. We're out of time on today's program. I hope you enjoyed our colorful conversation as much as I did. Again, for photos of Mr. Bertolli, you can punch in hometownheroesradio.com or visit the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.